And a special thanks to Dr. Fatima Sidat. We are running behind and we are due for a coffee break. What I'm going to suggest, with the permission of Sheikh Ihsan, maybe Sheikh Ihsan, if you can give your address and then we can break for coffee. Would the audience be agreeable to that? Sheikh Ihsan said he won't talk for long. Without further ado, let me first of all thank our panel for their excellent inputs, very thought-provoking, and I must confess, as a journalist, I've lost hair and gone grey covering this issue of Muslim marriages for 23 years, I must confess. Our next session is going to be having a look at the current status. It's applying Islamic law within a Muslim minority concept, a South African case study, and the South African to do it is Maulana Ihsan Talib, who is also the principal of IPSA. He wears many other hats and turbans, but this morning he is from IPSA. Shukran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله صلوات الله وسلامه عليه وعلى آله وصحبه وبارك وسلم. Firstly, I perhaps also need to make the point that before we break, and I'll really try to be quick about it, inshallah, is that it's perhaps fortuitous that our respondent, Maulana Ihsan Hendricks, has also informed last night that due to ill health, he has had to withdraw from the proceedings this morning. So that helps us along in terms of time, but I was really looking forward also to his presentation. So the question of applying Islamic law legislation within a Muslim minority context and really looking, starting to look at South Africa as a case study. So from an outline perspective, question which I wish to pose is, what is Islamic law? This may be a question which seems redundant, but I think it is quite important for us to reflect. The Sharia and change in fatwa, and then also a particular principle, I think, which is valid and relevant for us, is the fundamental rule in Muslim relations with others. And then looking at a fiqh of minorities, as well as then traversing from a fiqh of minorities to a fiqh of citizenship. And incidentally, the reason why I was looking forward to Maulana Ihsan Hendricks' presentation also today is that he has really cultivated a passion to talk about the fiqh of citizenship in particular. Nonetheless, so the first question then we're posing is, what is Sharia? And if we look at this particular slide here, we'll find that on your left, and looking at the big circle, we are referring to Sharia as revealed Sharia. And in the revealed Sharia, we have the Quran and the prophetic tradition. And to be noted also is that the prophetic tradition is not in its entirety inside the circle of the revealed Sharia. And then the next space there that we're looking at is that how all of that feeds into the development of fiqh and the relevance of urf in that particular regard that has been mentioned. And then a third level or tier of development, which is known sort of more generally as siyasa shar'iyya, which is public-oriented policy and the formulation of qanun. And qanun is then sort of translated as processes of legislation, so legislative processes. And so I think it is really critical for us to really at least be cognizant of these three tiers of the operation of Islamic law, because it is patent from sometimes within ulama circles that we cross the boundaries in terms of what is Islamic law? Is Islamic law Sharia? Is Islamic law fiqh? So when we're talking about Islamic law, we are referring to both of them. And an area which, of course, from a South African perspective, is where the process of the Muslim Marriage Bill really fits into, which is the development of legislation. And that, from the classical sources perspective, is within the realm of what is known as siyasa shar'iyya. Okay, so to come back to the first sort of space and tier, the Quran, of course, is what we have as the first and primary source, which is known as the Sharia. And so the Quran, in all its content, we believe to be immutable. The Quran is established decisively, يعني قطعيا, as well as the fact that it's, on the other hand though, when it comes to its implications of how these texts, the sacred texts, may be interpreted, that may be a different story, because albeit that in its entirety it is established authentically in a decisive, qat'i manner, its implications are not necessarily as such, and that for the most part of it, the interpretation of the sacred texts are open to different opinions. And so its indications and its implications therefore are dhanni for the most part, which is speculatory, and it is for that reason that obviously when we look at the next tier, which is the fiqh, where you have this plethora and this array of different schools of thought of jurisprudence. So the Quran then has, very importantly, those two very specific, I think, characteristics which are very important for us to consider. Secondly, if we look at the prophetic tradition, we will find that the prophetic tradition, similarly, is obviously regarded as, like the Quran is the primary, the Hadith is the secondary source of legislation in Islam. And so the prophetic tradition then becomes part of the revealed Sharia. To the extent that obviously we have, as we do also, that the same characterization of قطعي الثبوت, in other words, that it is decisively authenticated, you may have the category of the hadith which is sunnah, or the sunnah which is mutawatira, but then you have those that are not necessarily authenticated as decisively as is the criteria that is applied to the Quran, and that there again the application of the speculatory sort of criteria becomes relevant and applicable to the this prophetic sunnah in terms of its authentication. In terms of the actual content of the prophetic tradition, is where the ABC references come in. And so from the perspective of the usul, our ulama have made distinctions between what are the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ that is intended to be legislation, normative, tashri'i, and what are the component and the content of the sunnah that is not intended to be tashri'i, legislative, and there are then the three categories that apply here. And so the first one we'll have is that which is tashri'i, which is where really A fits in, and it's part of the revealed Sharia. And in that particular context there, the Prophet ﷺ would have then acted in one of three capacities. Either as the messenger of Allah that conveys Allah Ta'ala's mission to humanity, or to conveys the message to humanity as his mission, or he may then, in other words, as a Rasul. Secondly, he may be acting in his capacity as a judge where he has to settle disputes in society. And so the access to those categories of sunnah is not open for everyone, but for people who are in similar positions who have to dispense with disputes. And the third category is the category where the Prophet ﷺ would have acted as a leader or the ruler of the state. Again, those categories are not accessible widely to everyone, you and me here as lay people, but normative in terms of the ruler, the leader, and government. Then we have the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ, which is non-normative, غير تشريعي, in other words, it's not for legislative purposes. And this sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ is then further categorized into two areas. And that is where the Prophet ﷺ then would be either recorded and reported to be doing things that human beings normally do. Right? So in the way in which the Prophet ﷺ, for example, would have conducted his affairs as a human being in society, would have been one of the members of society, and he would have done the same things that everybody else is doing in society. And so those traditions which are then narrated of the Prophet ﷺ is not intended to be normative. And so the way in which the Prophet ﷺ, for example, would have dressed is not something which is exclusive to the Muslims in the community. The dress code of Islam is very clear in terms of what are the criteria that need to be confirmed in terms of awrah and covering, etc., etc. But the mode of the clothes or the clothing pieces are informed by the culture or the urf of the society. So those are, yes, incorporated. You'll find them referenced in Bukhari, etc., etc., but they are not intended to be normative. And so as, for example, as I'm standing here in front of you, I'm looking slightly different than somebody, for example, that he's like Sheikh Nuruddin, Muhammad Nuruddin Limu, for example, was. And so his attire is far more identifiable to the Nigerian context and culture, and this is kind of not identifiable. So at the same time, when we then look at that which is non-tashri'i, non-normative, we also have issues where the Prophet ﷺ would have guided and given advice, and very commonly, the Prophet ﷺ would be asked by the companions, O Prophet of Allah, is this revelation or is this your opinion? They would ask, is this revelation or is this your opinion? And in many instances, the Prophet ﷺ would say, no, but I'm just doing this because this is what I think is a good idea. But tell me what you think. And then they would tell the Prophet ﷺ, and there are many, many incidences like this, whether it is in the form of warfare and strategies and stratagems, or whether it's in the form of agricultural kind of methodologies that are being employed by the farmers, etc., etc., and so forth. And so those are not intended, obviously, to be normative. And we will then find that B and C falls outside the revealed Sharia. And is not intended to be part of the revealed Sharia. Then, if we move from there and go to the development of the fiqh. The fiqh is obviously, from just terminology perspective, we use the word Islamic law. But then sometimes when we speak about Sharia, we also use the term Islamic law. But the two are distinctly different concepts. And so when we talk about the fiqh, it's not about revelation. It's about the processes of interpretation, understanding, and making sense of what is contained in the sacred text. And those formulations have then been recorded as well as being developed into the jurisprudence then more accurately over the periods, the epochs. And those jurisprudences and its development was once again very key in its formulation was the question of the urf of society. Was the whole notion of also perhaps synonymous with the urf, the ada, the sort of norms and the customary practices of society. And so in its interpretation, like Shaykh Muhammad Limu had also referred to, for purposes of what recognition of marriage laws would mean for us in a South African context, the considerations are extremely, and is required to be extremely, context sensitive. And so contextualization becomes very, very key, and that is where urf obviously and ada also operates. So that is then therefore to be, I think the point just to be made is to say that sort of very, I think, reckless statements that are being made is to say and claims that are being made that those who want to see legislation take place are people that are interested in changing Islamic law. And then when the word is said changing Islamic law, it automatically also is just extended to Sharia. And then not just Sharia, but actually Quran wants to be changed. Which I think is really disingenuous and dishonest. But it could also be informed by ignorance. And so the whole then question that then develops from there is what we then have as a norm in the Muslim world, where the processes of legislation and the development of legislation is far more mature than obviously our own first encounter here in as a Muslim community. And so it's not as if this hasn't happened yet. If you go to different countries in different parts of the world, especially in the field of family law, obviously this is something which is quite developed. And so here we're talking about qanun and siyasa shari'iyya, which is public-oriented policy, which is then employed by the ruler, by the government. And this is where Sheikh Riyad's point comes in, is because the ruler then will then extract from all of the sources which, or all the options that could be available within the corpus of the jurisprudence, the legislative process, the ruler, or in this instance, in our case, the legislature or parliament, will then look at all the options that are available there, and perhaps that are not available, that could still become available, that are then formulated as the most appropriate in accordance with the urf of the South African context here, and then obviously having formulated that, having, and here obviously the process of formulation in a legislative context with a parliamentary dispensation is where there is public participatory processes, which we obviously are all part of. And so the ulama, Muslim community, academicians, everyone, they are all part of that process. So when then we all manage to find a consensus, if inshallah we can do so, we are then able to enjoy the deficiency which was lamented earlier on by Sheikh Riyad Fattah, that the executive authority of government is then squarely behind the implementation of that piece of legislation which everybody would have contributed towards developing. And I think this siyasa shar'iyya, many examples of course of this as well, but very perhaps appropriately, is if one looks for example at what Sayyidina Umar radiallahu anhu had done at the time when he found that there was just a sense of almost irresponsibility and recklessness with the way in which a talaq was pronounced in his time. And in his position as the Amir, as the ruler, he then, from a siyasa sharia perspective, public-oriented policy, determined and decreed that this folly that was somehow describing the context where three talaqs were being issued willy-nilly, he would then make those people accountable for their irresponsible attitudes and make the three talaqs in one sitting equivalent to three talaqs, as opposed to what it was before in the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, in the time of Sayyidina Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, and in his own khilafat, also in the first period, was that those three issuance of utterances would be regarded in one sitting as one single talaq. It is telling that a person like whom Sheikh Limu had also referenced, that towards the end of the life of Sayyidina Umar, Ibn al-Qayyim al-Jawzi, in his book on Usul I'lam al-Muwaqqi'een, says that Sayyidina Umar had in fact regretted that particular sort of position that he had instilled or that he had taken and applied in society. Nonetheless, so I think from our perspectives, the whole notion of what is Sharia, where is it that we're talking about the immutable law, the unchangeable laws of the Sharia, and where are the other areas, obviously, which speaks about jurisprudence, development of it in the context of Urf, and even further to that, Siyasa Shar'iyya, which is applied into a context of Qanun. The Qanun then, again, enjoys the... And that is where in the Muslim world how it has happened. Where the formation and the formulation of the bill before it becomes an act is then something which, because of the presence and the participation of everyone through parliamentary processes and the consensus that is reached on this piece of document, this then means that the assent by government of this piece of legislation into as an act, then removes all disputes that you find in the different madahib. So there's no fanaticism about the Hanafi madhab, there's no insistence about the Shafi'i position, there's no insistence about that. But all of it becomes part of this for a piece of legislation for purposes of implementation and application. And that is really critical, because also in a qawa'id fiqhiyya, the legal maxims perspective, the maxim leads and says that حُكْمُ الْحَاكِمْ يَرْفَعُ الْإِخْتِلَافِ, that the command of the government dissipates with all forms of disagreements, etc. Shafiq, we'll rush through here, so sorry about that. And so the next slide that we're looking at is Sharia and change in fatwa. Change in ruling based on change in time is not reprehensible is yet again another fiqh maxim that says لَا يُنْكَرُ تَغَيُّرُ الْأَحْكَامِ بِتَغَيُّرُ الْأَزْمَانِ. So when times change, it is not reprehensible, it's not frowned upon that the rules and ahkam also change. And then perhaps to just preface or put a rider to that, pertain to the questions again of ijtihad, which pertains to the bulk of the laws of the jurisprudence. And these changes that will attract change in fatwa can be as a result of change in place, change in time, change in condition, and change in custom and urf. Okay? So again, the question of change in time is more reference to fasadu zaman, where people have become less ethical in their conduct amongst one another, etc., etc. And so, yeah, there's all sorts of examples for that as well. Next slide. When we look at our condition and situation as South Africans, I think the development of the fiqh of minorities as a separate sphere, a separate space of academic endeavor and development for jurisprudence is very, very important. And importantly there in particular is the whole relationship of Muslims with non-Muslims and how we interact with the secular context which we found ourselves in, which clearly the Quranic reference in 68-9 Surah Al-Mumtahida makes very, very clear that Muslims obviously do not have any form of limitations in the way in which they interact with the environment, with non-Muslims, on the basis of those verses there. Next slide. If we then look at the fiqh of minorities, this is just a quote here from Professor Ashin Kamali's fiqh of minorities in light of the higher objectives of the Sharia. And so the whole idea, obviously, of the challenges that are faced by Muslims, because they are in a secular dispensation, and that the culture and the environment around them is one which may be at variance with their own kind of sensibilities. I think for us as Muslims in this country, we have a far stronger position in terms of how we relate to the fiqh of minorities compared to, say, for example, in Europe, where the age of those communities there is relatively young compared to our own existence here, and we really don't have any hang-ups in terms of how we relate to our environment, how we interact with the judicial structures and the system, how we interact with government, and our roles as citizens in the country. At the same time, however, it is important to note that there have been people who have been trailblazing in this regard, the likes of Qaradawi, the likes of Taha Jaber al-Alwani, the likes of Professor Hashim Kamali himself, and many of them have obviously made the point to say that this is not a rupture from the classical fiqh, it is but an extension of the classical fiqh. And so I think that's an important point for us also to bear in mind. And so the next slide, we're looking obviously at then the higher purposes of the Sharia and the very discussions that Sheikh Muhammad Limu, which I don't think we have to repeat right now, have had this morning in terms of how would the formulation of legislation be guided and governed by the questions of interest, the well-being of society, the masalih of society. The references obviously there to Ibn al-Qayyim's statement about the Sharia in its entirety being about masalih, and that that is basically its structure. And then also the references to hifdhul, the preservation of life, preservation of faith, the preservation, and those six obviously guiding principles there, that whenever, and this is the important part, whenever we interpret text of the Sunnah and text of the Quran, which may be less than explicit in its implication, we must always remember that its interpretation must always be guided and governed by these higher purposes and values of the Sharia. And that when anything of interpretive processes go in contravention thereto, it will be struck down to make sure that it becomes harmonized with the higher purposes of the Sharia. And so, in the next slide, the question obviously that we as in Islam, there is this fundamental principle about the respect for the rule of law, that where we find ourselves, we uphold the law. And that Ibn Taymiyyah's little statement there, better living 60 years under tyranny than one night under anarchy, is not to justify tyranny, but is to highlight how seriously Islam views the question of the rule of law. And so I think that for us is very important. For us as Muslims, again living in South Africa, we must be guided by the fact that the Muslim world views Muslims in South Africa almost enviously at times for how good we have it, for the freedoms we enjoy, for the protections we enjoy, and all of this obviously, as Professor Fatima also referenced, obviously comes out of our constitution. So all the guarantees, all the freedoms in the Bill of Rights, and comes obviously also with the question of constitutional supremacy. And so how constitutional supremacy is navigated, I think for us, is also not an impossible task. Some of the issues in the current bill, notwithstanding, were being considered in light thereof, even though that may not be the ultimate yet. And if where we are at right now, and some of the informed opinions believe that this will, the current case that's in the Western Cape High Court will land up again in the Constitutional Court, it will hopefully afford us the opportunity once again to become a little bit far more engaging of these processes in that regard. And so navigating a pathway for creating a viable legislative framework to secure the bulk of Muslim marriage, divorce and customary laws are then accommodated is something which is of extreme, I think, utmost important for us, given the preceding presentations that had been made. And Sayyidina Umar radiallahu anh, in the last presentation or slide, he then references something similar to that effect. And he speaks to one of his judges, which are appointed outside the precincts of Al-Madinah, by the name of Shuraih. And he speaks to him about the importance of the delivery of rights and the securing of rights. And that if, in essence, the legislation, whether it's the Quran and the Sunnah, is about justice, it's really a duty to be talking about justice when we cannot deliver justice, and that when we cannot execute justice on the ground. And that's his kind of reference to one of his judges. And then the reference that I made already in closing was that the legal maxim says that the authority of the executive eliminates disputes is something which is there for us as a tool. And when we then become to a point where consensus can be forged, it then obviously affords us the opportunity to have a piece of legislation in front of us that we know that the Sharia then justifies and vindicates, that when executive authority and legislative authority and parliamentary authority is assented to, then obviously it means we would be able to live, inshallah, harmoniously without having nightmares about which madhab we belong to and which madhab we don't belong to. Shukran very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.